Welcome, everybody. This is the first class for the Mises Academy online course, Basics of Economics of the Free Market. So this is, or Introduction to the Free Market. This is the second part of our three-part series going through this book, Lessons for the Young Economist. In this course, we're also, I don't have a physical copy to hold up for you, but we're also going to be using David Gordon's introductory book. And so if you're confused, just remember, go to the Academy login website and you'll see the actual syllabus. Okay, today's lecture is on indirect exchange and the emergence of money. You can see here the outline. Got a lot to cover, so we'll go ahead and get going. How the course works, I'll just go through this very briefly because I think a lot of you have taken courses from me. So like I said, the main textbook is going to be Lessons for the Young Economist, and then this is going to be the background, the secondary textbook, David Gordon's Introduction to Economic Reasoning. And in case you somehow didn't get the memo, remember, and Danny's putting in the chat box there, a link to David Gordon's book. So both of these things are available for free, the PDF through Mises.org. You use Google for them. But remember, if you want a physical copy of David Gordon's book, or sorry, by Kim, by signing up for this course, you're not eligible to get the free book. You just pay shipping. Okay, so if you weren't aware of that, just go look at the information on this course again, and you can get all that information. So of course the main lecture will be from 5:30 to 7 Eastern time on what's today, Thursdays, like this is happening right now. When applicable, because I'm traveling a lot, so there might be one or two times when I just can't do it, but when applicable, I will give you guys a heads up for when the office hours are going to be, and that's just that's totally voluntary. That's just a forum for you. It's like this, except it's on Saturdays, and it's an hour session where you can ask me whatever you want. It can be about this course, or it can be about Chris Christie. It can be about anything you want. And you don't need to have watched those in order to do well in the class. If you're taking this course for credit, just make sure you keep up with the quizzes and then the final and all that stuff. You'll be getting emails from me telling you when that stuff posted. And you always have a rolling 2-week window when some new quiz or exam is posted. Okay, you don't need to tell me if you're not taking the course for credit, just don't ever do the quizzes and we'll get the picture. Okay, I think that's all we need to focus on here. Let me say before I forget, for this book, if you look at the syllabus, you'll see we don't actually cover, four or five chapters from it explicitly in this course. But part of the reason for that is that a lot of David's book would have been relevant to the stuff that we did in part one of this three-part series. Okay, so where we were going over the nature of economic science and how do you test claims and what does it mean if something's a priori and that kind of stuff. What's the difference between economics or so the social sciences more generally compared to the natural sciences? How is it that we learn truths in economics? And we saw that that's a different type of procedure from the way a physicist or a chemist figures out the principles of the laws in their respective fields. So a lot of that stuff is handled very well and very intuitively by David in his book. It's just we've already moved past that material for those of you who have been with me so far and going through Lessons for the Young Economist. All right, so it certainly wouldn't hurt you, especially if you get your hand on the physical copy of David's book. By all means, start at the beginning and keep reading till you get caught up with where we are in this course. So the fact that I'm not assigning that stuff just means because we've moved beyond a lot of his earlier stuff that would have been relevant for the things we did before. But it's still very good and it might help you. Okay, I see someone asking in the question, when do I announce time for Saturday office hours? I will usually blast it out the Friday beforehand. just because I the course, you know, happens on a Thursday, and then by the next day I'll figure out what's going on. It'll bounce around too, partly because I may have stuff going on, but also I know some of you guys have things you're doing on Saturday, so I don't want to always have it be the same time. Okay. Also, all these things are always recorded, just in case you don't know that. So if for some reason, you know, you had something going on Saturday, but you really want to go to the office hour, it's not like you have to choose. You can just watch the recording later. One last housekeeping thing. It's not as big a deal right now, but on these Thursday nights sessions, if you have a question for me regarding the content, like an academic question, then go ahead and put it in the Q&A box, which is distinct from the chat box. But like if I'm talking and all of a sudden the sound goes out or something like that, then that's something you might want to put in the chat and just say, hey, I can't hear anything. Can anyone else hear anything? That sort of thing. All right. So you guys can be talking to each other in the chat box. I typically am not going to follow that closely. I just kind of glance down occasionally to make sure you guys aren't waving your arms up and down to, hey, the audio went out, something like that. And then at the end of these Thursday night sessions, I'll try to keep 15 minutes or so open, and then I'll go to the Q&A box and try to knock out those questions. Okay, so the limits of direct exchange. Let me just do a very quick review from last class. Incidentally, let me just reassure you, if you didn't sign up for this, the part one of this, where we went through chapters 1 through 6 of Lessons for the Young Economist, that's okay. You still should probably read that stuff to truly get up to speed, but you can jump right into this class and you'll be fine. So in the interest both of just refreshing everyone's memory, or for some of you maybe this is the first time you would have heard this, let me just remind you what the difference is between a direct exchange and an indirect exchange. All right, so direct exchange means that there's an exchange occurring, obviously, and both parties are going to directly use the good or the service that they're acquiring. Okay? So, and it doesn't mean they're going to consume it. They could use it in production. But the point is, they're not going to acquire it intending to trade it away again in the future. And so that's what makes something a direct exchange. If both parties for the thing they're receiving plan on using it directly, either to consume it or to somehow use it in production. Okay, so that's a direct exchange. Why don't we just limit ourselves to that for right now? So there's plenty of benefits to direct exchange. Ex ante, meaning at the beginning or at the outset, as long as it's voluntary, both parties benefit from it. We spent a lot of time last course hammering home this point. Let me just say very quickly again, because it's crucial. This simple insight, I'll go ahead and type it out because it's so important, that in a voluntary exchange, my keyboard's messed up. The top row is sticky. Let me switch to the pen. This is funny. It's not a problem with the internet connection. My keyboard's actually messed up. Both parties benefit. And there's supposed to be a Y there. Okay. So in a voluntary exchange, both parties benefit. And that's not an empirical fact, okay? And this is kind of the sort of nature of statements in economics that we really spent a lot of time last course dwelling on, and I'm just going to just fire off some reminders in this introductory lecture today just to get you thinking about that again. But, I mean, that statement, if you think about it, in a voluntary exchange, both parties benefit, that right there crystallizes what it is that people, especially in tradition of Murray Rothbard, but what they mean when they say, hey, there's something very special going on in economics and the type of statements we make, they're not things that you go empirically test. but yet they're not merely tautologies. It's not merely a definition. Okay, and this statement is a perfect example of that. Because in a voluntary exchange, it's not true that by definition both parties benefit, right? If you go look up voluntary in the dictionary, it doesn't say a situation in which both parties have higher utility or achieve a higher rank on their preference scale. That's not what Oxford Dictionary is going to say, right? It's going to say something like a situation where both parties approve of it or they don't object or you know, something like that, or there's no force involved or there's no coercion, okay? So, or it's willing. That's what voluntary means. So you need to know something about economics to understand, to make that connection to say, oh, wait a minute, if a trade or exchange is voluntary, that means both parties, at least in the beginning with their assessment, their anticipation of what that good is going to do for them that they're getting in the exchange, they're better off. Okay. But yet, and so again, though, that's not something we go test. We don't go out and take a sample of 1,000 different people who engage in an exchange where they've all reported, yes, this is voluntary, and then say, you know, are you better off now, the moment after they make the trade? And then you'll go and look and say what percentage said they were better off. That's not, you just think through the nature of the statement and what the terms mean, and then the answer pops up. But again, it's not quite the same thing as saying a bachelor is unmarried. That really is, just by definition, that's what we mean by the word bachelor. Okay, so point is direct exchange is great. And we ended up the last course walking through very methodically how it is that we come up with exchange ratios or prices, barter prices, if you want to call them that, in a direct exchange economy. And that was the Halloween candy example. And so that everybody participating in the direct exchange walked away better off. And we pointed out that simple insight, obvious though it may seem to you, tripped up some of the greatest philosophers and political theorists of all time, because they just got off on the wrong footing because they didn't understand what value was in the context of an economy or markets or goods and services. All right, so Aristotle wrote on this subject and started a whole tradition of thought in which people believed that in order for an exchange to be just or moral or fair, the goods being traded had to be of comparable value. Right, and I'm sure he had a lot of nuances and so forth. And there's a whole thing with the Catholic Church, people writing on that as well. And the problem, though, is that we're saying something different, or we're saying, no, in an exchange, both parties walk away with the item that's more valuable. And at first, that sounds impossible. But the solution to that is, the reason that is possible, is that value is subjective, right? It's not an objective feature of the object. So it's not possible, at least with our understanding of the way physics works, it's not possible in a direct exchange for both parties to walk away with the object that's heavier or the object that has more calories, right? One of them has to have more than the other, or they have exactly the same. But it can't possibly be the case if two people trade goods that they both walk away with goods that are heavier than the good they started out with. That can't be. But it is possible that they both walk away with something they value more than what they gave up, because again, value is subjective. Okay, so the point is direct exchange is great. Now we're taking it further though. We're gonna say, you know what, as good as direct exchange is, even though it allows everybody who participates in it to walk away better than they were in the beginning, nonetheless, there are limits. And that's where we start on today's lecture. So I don't think I use this phrase in the textbook. And remember, just for those of you who perhaps are homeschool on the younger side, what I'm going to be doing in these lectures is occasionally supplementing the discussion with things that are a little bit more advanced and more directly relevant to Austrian economics. So this book even though it's consistent with Austrian economics, even though I am an Austrian economist and wrote it, so obviously everything that I was sort of distilling and boiling down to an easy to understand level of explanation came from Austrian theory. Strictly speaking, this book is not an Austrian textbook, right? That just generic free market economists, I would like to think, can read this and agree with just about everything in it, perhaps everything in it. All right, so we are trying to make this as accessible as possible so that plenty of homeschooling people who just wanted to have an education in free market economics could find this to be like a gateway into this literature. Okay. But in this course, since we're teaching it through the auspices of the Mises Academy, I am going to be occasionally bringing in some stuff to supplement it. So don't be afraid of that. It's not going to be super hard or anything like that. You can still do fine on the tests, but I just want to make sure you realize that's the way we structure these things. Okay, so one example of that, what made me go off on that tangent for a moment, was I don't think I used this phrase in the textbook, but if you go on in economics, you'll hear it all the time. So one way of explaining the limits of direct exchange is to say that it suffers from the problem of you need a double coincidence of wants. And what that means is, in a direct exchange, remember, by definition, what it means is both parties plan on directly using the thing that they're acquiring. So an easy way to, the way I like to summarize this problem, is to say, in a world of limited to direct exchange, that's all anybody could do, either use the things they were naturally starting out with, or you could only trade with people where you were going to directly use the thing you got, and the person you were trading with was going to directly use the thing you were giving up. Imagine you were a dentist, and you were in the mood to eat a steak, and you didn't have a steak yourself, so you had to go trade with somebody. Well, the only way that would work is you would have to go find a butcher who happened to have a toothache at that moment. You see how that works? Because you want to go get a steak from somebody. What do you have to offer if you're a dentist? Well, your services and helping people with their teeth. And so you'd have to find a butcher with a toothache. All right. Or a butcher who wanted his teeth cleaned or what have you. But you get the idea, who had a cavity that needed to be filled. Right. So that's the problem. And so if you really think that through, what that probably means in practice is that in a world limited to direct exchange, nobody would be a dentist. That would be way too specialized of an occupation. And nobody would be a third grade teacher. Because again, you would have to find either the students or the parents paying on their behalf. You know, you'd have to have one student parents giving you shelter to teach their kid how to multiply, and then you'd have to have another family sending their kid to your class, and they would give you tuna fish, and another family would be giving you electricity, and another family would be giving you clothes. You see how that works? Because nobody is allowed to get something that they then need to go buy something else with. So I'm just trying to get you to understand what it is ultimately where we're going with this is to see the benefits of having money. But the way to start out is to say, imagine if all we were allowed to use were direct exchange. Okay. So the point is, in such a world like that, with those limitations, it actually, you wouldn't have the absurdity of a dentist walking around looking for a butcher with a toothache. There wouldn't be such a thing as a butcher and a dentist. Everybody would probably be pretty self-sufficient. It would just engage in occasional trade with people to get rid of their surplus items, but people would make their own clothes, they would grow their own food, or they would go hunt for their own food, and so on. And there probably wouldn't be somebody who spent the majority of his day just doing one thing, because for the reasons we just went over. Okay. So in a book we walk through then the emergence of indirect exchange. So first let's just define what I mean by that term. It's anything that's not a direct exchange. So if a direct exchange means both parties plan on directly using the good they acquired, an indirect exchange just means at least one of the parties does not intend to directly use the thing being acquired. So you might say, well, what's the person going to do with it if he's not going to use it for consumption or production? Well, he's going to hold on to it, intending to trade it away again down the road for something else. Okay, so let me just make sure you understood this example that we walked through in the text. Oh, incidentally, I didn't say this in the beginning, but in case you're new, obviously this opening first week lecture you might not have had a chance to, but in general, for optimal results, you're going to want to do the assigned reading before that week's lecture. So, for example, going into next week, try to do the reading for week two before the lecture, and you'll get more out of it. Okay, so here the example is, start with this guy. So that's a farmer, and he starts out with eggs. The problem is he's got tattered shoes. And what these boxes are showing are the rankings from best to worst of the three different goods or services that are being depicted in this little story. So the farmer here, the thing he wants the most is to have repaired shoes. His second best choice is to have the eggs that he happens to start out with, because he's the one who owns the chickens. And then the third best thing for him is to get bacon. Okay. Now there's also in this economy a butcher, and he starts out with the bacon. His preference is the best thing for him is to get the egg. The next best thing is to keep his bacon, what he starts out with. And the third best thing is to have the cobbler repair his shoes. Okay, so it's not saying he's going to get the shoes from the farmer. It's saying, would he want the cobbler to come work on his, the butcher's, shoes? And the point of this ranking is to say that's the least valuable thing in his eyes. Okay, so suppose the economy just had these two people. Is there any gain from trade that's possible? And the answer is no. The butcher would like to trade his bacon for the farmer's eggs, because you see here, the eggs in the butcher's mind are more valuable than the bacon. That's because they're at the first ranking and the bacon's only at the second ranking. So the butcher would be happy to make that trade, but the problem is the farmer would not, because for the farmer, the eggs are higher than the bacon. So why would he give up the eggs in exchange for the bacon? Because now he's moving from his second best thing down to his third best thing. Why would he do that? So there's no voluntary trade possible if we're talking about direct exchange. And by the same token, just real quickly here, consider the farmer just looking at the cobbler. The cobbler is a person who fixes shoes. Is there a trade possible there? Well, the farmer would love to give up his eggs in exchange for the cobbler repairing his shoes. You can see that because that's, you know, his first thing is the repaired shoes and the second thing is the eggs. But the cobbler would not want to make that trade, because for him, his leisure is preferable to the eggs. So from the cobbler's point of view, he can either just relax or he can work on somebody's shoes. And so to get him, so the point is, if he's going to repair the farmer's shoes, that means he doesn't get to enjoy his leisure. And so the point is, would he be willing to give up his leisure in exchange for the farmer's eggs? And according to this diagram, the answer is no, he would not. All right. I'm not going to walk through it, but you can check for yourself that the butcher and the cobbler also, there's no gain from trade there. Okay, so the point is, with these three guys, with just these three possible goods and services, if all we had were direct exchange, nothing would happen. They would all just keep what they started out with. But suppose we allow for indirect exchange. Now we have a new opportunity here, and everybody in this community can now become better off. So let's just step back for a minute here before we dive into the details. There we see why that's a good thing, right? I'm going to show you how, with, you know, so we already just, I just showed you with direct exchange, everybody stays the same. Now with indirect exchange, every single person in this little group here is going to end up with a thing that he values more than what he started out with. So that's the sense in which indirect exchange will make everyone in this little society richer. They'll end up with things that are more valuable, but we just proved that rearrangement of goods would not have been possible limited to direct exchange. So this is just the whole point of this example is I'm trying to get you to see how it is that allowing for indirect exchange is another avenue by which goods can get allocated to people where they're more valuable so that everybody ends up happier, subjectively speaking. Everybody in his own mind ends up with something more valuable because of indirect exchange. Okay, so let's just walk through the logistics of it. The farmer goes ahead and gives the eggs to the butcher, and the butcher goes ahead and gives the bacon to the farmer. Now, we already saw if that were the end of the story, that would have been a silly thing for the farmer to do. He doesn't like the bacon more than the eggs. But he's not viewing the bacon in terms of its consumption, in terms of what it can directly do for him. Instead, he's going to use it to then offer to the cobbler, because the cobbler thinks the bacon is worth more than his leisure. So when the farmer now, with the bacon, not with the eggs, goes to the cobbler, he says, hey, let me give you this bacon. Will you fix my shoes? And the cobbler says, sure. So he fixes the guy's shoe. Okay, so when all is said and done, the farmer ends up with repaired shoes for which he ultimately gave up his eggs. So he's better off than in the original status quo. The butcher ends up with the farmer's eggs for which he gave up his bacon. So he's better off in his mind. And the cobbler ends up with the bacon for which he forfeited or sacrificed his leisure. So he's better off in his mind. So all three guys are happier after the indirect exchanges than they were at the outset. Okay. So one last thing on this slide. In that little story I just told you, the bacon served as a medium of exchange. Okay, the word is medium. So it's spelled the same, you know, like cold, medium, hot, or small, medium, large, that it means in the middle of. Okay, it's the same word, but in this kind of context, what it means, it's closer to, if you're familiar with using medium, like the artist could use the medium of a canvas and paint, or you could say that sound waves need a medium to travel through. Like sound waves can travel through air, or they can travel through water, but sound waves can't travel through empty space because they need a medium. Right, so a medium is something through which things move. And in the economics context, to call something a medium of exchange is trying to say that it's something through which the ultimate exchanges occur. So in this example, the bacon is the medium of exchange because the farmer accepted the bacon not because he wanted to consume it, not because he viewed it as a consumption good, but because he viewed it as an exchange good. And so, you know, the bacon, in a sense, went from the butcher to the farmer and then from the farmer to the cobbler. And so that's the sense in which the bacon was a medium of exchange. Another way of seeing it is that in an indirect exchange, the good that is being acquired with the intention of giving it up again in the future, that's the medium of exchange. So in an indirect exchange, there at least one of the goods has to be a medium of exchange. They could both be, but at least one of them has to be. And so in this story that we just told, the bacon was a medium of exchange. And strictly speaking, if you really want to get picky about it, it only served as a medium of exchange in this trade. when it was when the farmer accepted it in exchange for his eggs. In that trade, the bacon was a medium of exchange, but then when he gave it to the cobbler, you know, that actually, just viewed in isolation, that was just a direct exchange. Because once the farmer had the bacon in his possession, he was trading it for his repaired shoes, and that was a direct, you know, he was directly going to use the repaired shoes, and the cobbler was going to directly eat the bacon. Okay? So now that you've seen what direct exchange is, you now have seen an example of indirect exchange, you know the definition, and I just told you what it meant for something to be a medium of exchange. Let me now define for you what money is. Well, money is a medium of exchange, okay, but there's something more. It's a medium of exchange, that's like condition A. But then there's also condition B that is commonly accepted by members of the market. All right, so money is a special kind of medium of exchange. So all money are media of exchange. Right, so the plural of medium is media. So any example of money you could show me is also a medium of exchange, but it doesn't go the other way. Something could be a medium of exchange, but not be money. It's like all Great Danes are dogs, but not all dogs are Great Danes. All right. So what qualities are good for money? So what I'm trying to get you to see here is we've seen, hypothetically speaking, why people might use indirect exchange, because there's a limit to direct exchange, and once people had made all the direct exchanges that they could, then they would open up their eyes and they would start looking for indirect exchanges to make. And so in that example we just walked through, of course, very simplistic and perhaps silly, bacon happened to be the medium of exchange in that story. But in the real world, people don't use bacon as a medium of exchange. And why not? Well, because it wouldn't last very long, for one thing. So what I'm doing in this slide, and we want to walk through and say, okay, know what a medium of exchange is. And in practice, certain types of media of exchange were preferable. So maybe before I jump into this, let me go back a slide. I think maybe I went over that last one a little bit too fast. Let me dwell on this a little bit more. So if you're listening to the audio, I'm going back to the slide number 4, a definition of money. We've seen how things could emerge from the market as a medium of exchange. But what Carl Menger said, this was his theory of the origin of money, Carl Menger being the founder of the Austrian school, he said that in practice what happened is people were making trades, and then certain goods functioned very well as media of exchange. And so people, when they wanted to engage in an indirect exchange, they would start looking to acquire these things to be their medium, right? So they actually wouldn't go for bacon very often, because like I said, bacon, it wouldn't last very long, and we'll see in a minute. There's lots of reasons that bacon really wouldn't be a very good medium of exchange. So certain goods, though, more and more people would begin accepting them, even if they didn't want to directly use them. They would accept them knowing I'm going to use this thing in other exchanges down the road to get what I really want. And so Menger argued that had a snowball effect, that as more and more people began using one or two or a few commodities as media of exchange, that very willingness by the community to use those things made them better media of exchange, right? Because one of the things you would want in a medium of exchange is that a lot of people want it. You see how that works? That's the whole point. You want to get rid of what you have in order to get something that a lot of other people might want so that it enables you to get the things you need or you want. Okay, so as certain goods became more widely accepted, there was a snowball effect that made other people want to accept them. And so it just kept magnifying upon itself until the point at which one or two or maybe a few of these things were commonly accepted, meaning just about everybody in the community, when he or she wanted to get rid of something in exchange, if he couldn't find somebody who had exactly the mirror image of what he wanted, right? So somebody, a dentist wants to sell dental services and he wants a steak. If he can't find a butcher with the kind of steak he wants who exactly happens to need or want the dental services that that dentist can provide, well, then he's going to sell his dental services instead for a medium of exchange. And so the point is, if everybody in the community is willing to accept a particular good whenever they're in that kind of a situation as a medium of exchange, then that good is now money. It's not merely a medium of exchange, it's money, a special type of medium of exchange that just about everybody accepts. Right? So that's the historical progression of a medium of exchange becoming accepted in wider and wider circles until finally just about everybody within whatever market you're considering would accept that thing in any kind of transaction where they want to exchange away something or sell something, and then they're willing to accept this thing sort of like in the interim as a resting place or a holding pattern until they go buy the thing that they really wanted. Okay, so that's how a medium of exchange becomes money. So now the question is, what type of attributes would make people prefer one possible medium of exchange over another? Okay, so like I said, in that story we just told, I made bacon the medium of exchange. But in the real world, you probably wouldn't have bacon. I mean, some places might have like salted meat or something, but I don't think anyone actually used strips of bacon as a medium of exchange. All right, so what is it that makes things desirable as a medium of exchange? Well, I listed a few of the attributes in the textbook, so let me just make sure you understand what I was talking about. So one thing is ease of transport. So in some societies, we think that cattle might have functioned as a medium of exchange, but actually that might not have been. Yeah, you can move cattle from point A to point B because they can walk, but they also go to the bathroom on you. You got to feed them, that sort of thing. So it's not as obvious. If you want to go make a deal at the top of a skyscraper, it would be difficult logistically if you had to bring up 10 head of cattle just to get them up there. Okay, and so that's one consideration: the ease of transporting something. Another criterion is the visibility. So that's a huge strike against cattle. That if you wanted to buy something that the price of it happened to work out to 2.5 cattle, you don't want to have to cut the animal in half, right? Because it's not that two halves of the animal are just as good as one whole animal. You see how that works? That also is a strike against diamonds. That there's many reasons that you might think diamonds would be a very good medium of exchange, but divisibility is not one of them. It's not easy to take a diamond and cut it in half. And then if you did cut it in half, that diminishes its value, right? If you had a huge diamond and you smashed it into 10 pieces, It's not that each piece would be one-tenth as valuable as the original thing was. Okay, so that's, or a house would not be a good medium of exchange. A house would be bad for many reasons. It also wouldn't be easy to transport. Okay, or a truck would be easy to transport, but it wouldn't be very divisible. Okay. Durability. Okay, so here's the huge knock against bacon. Bacon would not be a very good medium of exchange because it's not going to last very long. Eggs are not a very good medium of exchange because they don't last very long. All right. Convenient market value by unit of weight. So this means that given so various goods in the marketplace exchange against each other in various proportions. And remember, at the end of the last class, in the previous section, that's what we went through. The market prices, they were barter ratios of the Halloween candy. Like we saw, under these conditions, two Snicker bars would exchange for one Milky Way, or one Snicker bar would trade for one Milky Way. All right, so that sort of consideration is still going to be true with lots and lots of goods. And so the point is, for something to be a convenient, or to be a good medium of exchange, or to ultimately be money, right? Because if something's a really good medium of exchange, that means lots of people want to use it. And so if enough people end up using it and embracing it, well, then that's what makes it a money. So for something to get to that status, again, this fourth consideration is saying what you'd like, ideally, is that your money, for the type of purchases you want to make, the amount of physical units of this thing in terms of the weight, I guess the size, that you're bringing to the market to make the trade is convenient. Right? And this will make more sense in a moment. I'll come back to this point. So now that I've given you just a rough overview of four of these possible considerations, notice we can now understand why it was historically that the metals, gold and silver, were embraced by the whole world as the monies, plural, of choice. All right, and we saw that. So plenty of things have been money throughout history in various cultures. But as the market economy developed and sort of embraced the whole planet, as more and more markets were opened and the international shipping really became dominant, that in the 1800s, as what we now know of as modern capitalism, sort of embraced a lot of the earth, what people gravitated toward as their monies of choice were gold and silver. And so we can see why that would be the case, because gold and silver are really good on all of these criteria. And, so take divisibility, for example. That's gold and silver. You can divide it very easily. Right? You can take gold coins and melt them down and then make them into smaller coins or make them into bigger coins or whatever. You can take a piece, a gold chalice and melt it down and make it into a gold brick or something. And that's not going to affect its value as gold per se. Whereas, like I said, with a diamond or something, you can't really do the same thing. Okay, something I don't have in this list. Another one would be homogeneity, and that's somewhat related to divisibility, where an ounce of gold is an ounce of gold in terms of its valuation, whereas that's not the same with diamonds or rubies. And then this point here about convenient market value, you might say, well, why gold and silver? Why not brass or copper, or why not platinum for that matter? And the reason is, or one of the reasons, is that gold and silver, for the type of exchanges that people wanted to make and for which they wanted to use money, gold and silver were pretty convenient. That for really big purchases, or you know, to get a bulk of the purchase, you would use gold coins, and then either for smaller purchases or to get the fractional amount correct on a big purchase, you would use the silver coins. Okay, whereas I mean, I guess there could be copper coins and things, and there were historically, but the point is that would be a very small transaction because copper was more abundant than gold and silver, so it didn't have a very high purchasing power by weight. So you would need a lot of copper. If you were going to go buy a horse, you would need a lot of copper to do that, where you wouldn't need as much gold by weight. So it just wouldn't be very convenient to actually go around buying stuff if you had to conduct all your transactions using copper as the actual metal that you were physically delivering. And that's something to make sure you realize. Yes, with the advent of banking and so on, things became easier, where people would just deposit their coins in bank and then write notes on them, or spend notes or write what we would call checks on them. But it was also the case that the actual coins were gold and silver. So, I mean, ultimately, the way you engaged in a transaction was you gave someone a hunk of metal when you were buying something, right? And that, for a lot of people now, that's an alien concept, because we're so used to our money being intrinsically worthless pieces of paper that the government just stamps and says, no, this is money officially. But the gold and silver coins and money back in the day, I mean, what you were actually buying things with was a certain weight of gold. And Mises talks about this, that for really large transactions, if you were going to do a big transaction, especially like if people were going to ship gold across the ocean to settle up on something, their trade flows and international clearing houses, and once in a while they would settle up, and so a ship would literally be carrying gold across the ocean from one vault to another. And Mises says that in those kind of big transactions, they would not go through and just count up the gold coins. That's not the way they calculated or did the accounting. No, they would actually get out scales and they would weigh it. Because really what you were supposed to deliver to the other party was a weight of gold. That was what the money was. It was not, hey, give me this many coins of gold. The unit of measurement, the denomination of the money, was in actual weight. It was a physical, it was metal. Okay. Just like to help you see that, if you were buying a lot of flour from somebody, you actually wouldn't be buying such and such bags of flour. You would be buying pounds of flour. And so the way you would ultimately measure that, if it were a huge amount, you would use scale to make sure you weren't getting ripped off, because there might not actually be 1 pound of flour in a bag labeled 1 pound. So you'd want, if you were buying thousands of pounds, you'd want to make sure that's what you were getting. So by the same token, if somebody was owed you 1,000 ounces of gold, you wouldn't just have them give you 1,000 coins that were stamped 1 ounce and just count up the coins. Yep, that looks good. No, you would weigh it and make sure, is this really 1,000 ounces of gold? Because it's possible the coins would be underweight. Okay. Let me spend a few moments talking about the contributions of Ludwig von Mises. So this, if you're a homeschooling student, this part is going to be a little bit tricky. And don't be scared off. I wouldn't, there's going to be like one question or something on this, so don't worry about this. But I do want to offer this for those more advanced students who might be taking this course. And I'll try to keep the language understandable for you. So the context here is, remember, in the early 1870s, Carl Menger, along with two other economists, William Stanley Jevons and Leon Walras, they independently are credited with coming up with the marginal utility theory of value. And this, we talked a little bit about this in the last course, and in this course, it's assigned later on, I can't remember exactly which week, but David Gordon has a chapter on the labor theory of value, and so there's there'll be a discussion there. So the classical economists, people like Adam Smith and David Ricardo, they had a labor theory of value. So they thought that ultimately the way to explain why it was that one horse trades for 16 pounds of flour, obviously just making that number up, in the marketplace when they saw the various exchange ratios, the way they tried to explain it was to say, well, it's because the horse has 16 times as much labor power going into bringing the horse to market. There's a lot more effort involved by various human beings along the way to raise a horse, to, you know, feed it, whatever, keep it in good condition, healthy, put horseshoes on it, whatever. You break, you know, when you break a horse and get it so that people can ride on it, whatever, if you want a horse to do, pull a stagecoach or something. That took, let's say, 16 times as many labor hours as it did to bring a pound of flour to market. And so that's why the horse would trade for 16 pounds of flour. Because they ultimately, again, it goes back to that mistake that Aristotle made, where they were looking at market value or economic value as a substance that had units. And it was like just out there in the universe, just like something could have calories or something could have mass or height. And those were an objective unit that were in principle measurable. By the same token, they thought that's what value must be like. And so if you see one horse trading for 16 pounds of flour, well, it must be that there's some kind of substance called value, and there's 16 times as much of that substance in the horse as there is in a single bag of flour that weighs a pound. And that, you know, in the market exchange, they thought that people were giving up equivalent amounts of whatever that substance was. Okay, so, and they were trying to figure out, well, what is the substance? And it was logical or reasonable to think it must ultimately be due to human labor, human effort, because that was the really scarce thing they thought in terms of the economy, with, you know, what would be the bottleneck of production? It would be that, well, geez, people don't like to work. And so the more effort that it takes to get something to come to market, that's the ultimate bottleneck or constraint. And so that kind of explains why, in the long run, you would see certain exchange ratios. Okay, so what I'm telling you is that view of the classical economists, and those guys were free market guys. Right, so Karl Marx, it's true, had a labor theory of value, but so did Adam Smith, and so did David Ricardo and John Stuart Mill. Okay, so that classical view was overturned in what is called the subjectivist revolution of the early 1870s. And so, again, I'm just repeating myself here. There were three economists who were independently credited with discovering this or making this contribution, and Karl Menger, who is the founder of the Austrian school, happened to be one of them. In his book, The Grundsatz, which we translate as Principles of Economics, among other things, well, that was like his primary contribution. He gave us what we now call subjective marginal utility theory. Okay, so very briefly, what did Menger do? He said, no, the classical economists are getting off on the wrong foot. The way to explain something's value, the reason the horse trades for 16 pounds of flour, is that people value things based on how it will help them satisfy their subjective goals or preferences. And once you have that insight, then, and people will only engage in a trade if they get more out of it than what they gave up. Right? So it's not an equality. It's not that if one horse is trading for 16 pounds of flour, we don't have to sit there and try to figure out, well, what is it about the horse that is 16 times as much as a pound of flour? Because you're trying to see some kind of equality there, that one horse equals 16 pounds of flour. And so they were trying to look at, in what sense does a horse equal 16 pounds of flour? And like I said, they came up with, oh, I know, labor hours that are congealed in it. Maybe that's what it is. Because obviously, one horse is not the same thing as 16 pounds of flour. But one thing is an animal that runs around on four legs, and the other thing is lifeless stuff that helps you make bread, right? So Menger got through that logjam. No, there is no equality. The person selling the horse for 16 bags of flour or 16 pounds of flour thinks the 16 pounds of flour are more valuable than that horse. And the person selling the flour thinks that particular horse is more valuable than the 16 pounds of flour he's giving up. Those 16 pounds. He might not do the trade again, right? And that's the crucial insight. You just think about that for a second. If it were really true that one horse traded for 16 pounds of flour because they were equal in some sense, well, then why wouldn't the horse seller just get rid of all his horses and acquire nothing but bags of flour? But that's not what he does. He sells some horses and buys some flour. He buys some sweaters. He buys this. You see what I'm saying? When you go to the grocery store and you see milk and you put 1 gallon of milk in your cart, it's not because you think, oh, well, let's see, the price on that is whatever, $3, and I think that milk is equal to $3 in value, and therefore I'm just breaking even. I'm doing equivalent swap here. Well, if that's the way you thought, well, then why don't you just fill your cart up with milk until you run out of dollars? But nobody does that. Okay, so what Menger gave was an explanation for why people engage in limited trade, but then they stop after a certain number of units. And that's, again, because the trade that you're making, I mean, units you're making, it's because there's an inequality of values. You're only going to buy gallons of milk when you think each unit that you're getting is more valuable than the dollars you have to give up. And at some point, the more milk you acquire, at some point, the next gallon you could get, you decide, no, that gallon, maybe it's the fifth one, is not as valuable to me as these $3, which are now, like my fourth, fifth, and sixth dollar, where maybe originally I was giving up my 21st, 22nd, and 23rd dollar. Because the more milk I buy, the fewer dollars I have. Okay, so that's what we mean by marginal utility. That it's, you look at the unit on the margin. Okay, so I hope these brief remarks, I'm just getting to see how what Menger gave was a completely different framework, but that totally explained what was going on. And it was just a far superior method to explaining market prices than what the classical economists have been doing. Okay, and the crucial thing was what he started out with was that value was subjective. That there wasn't this objective thing about a good, the way its weight or color is objective. No, value is subjective, meaning it's in the mind of the beholder. So one person might think a painting is very valuable and be willing to give up a lot of units of money for it. Somebody else might think, no, that's not even art. I don't even look at it. It's just, people threw paint on a canvas. That's disgusting. And they wouldn't give up anything at all for it. And there's no contradiction there. Okay. So I went on a digression just to make sure you guys had a general familiarity with what the subjective marginal revolution was and how it was that Karl Menger showed economists this is a much better framework to use to understand why goods trade against each other in the marketplace in certain ratios. So now we have a much better framework to explain why is it that a horse trades for 16 pounds of flour, let's say. Okay. well, wait a minute, what now about money? And here's the problem. It looked like, okay, so Menger's explanation, and again, Menger did it in roughly the same time, so did William Stanley Jevons and Lena Walras. Okay, so this new marginal subjectivist approach swept the economics field. And after a few decades, this was now the standard paradigm. But still, the problem was, so they could explain things in terms of direct exchange. And just like we did in Lessons for the Young Economist, the Halloween candy example, we were using that very framework. I mean, the techniques we used to represent stuff might have been different from how Menger would have done it, but the principle was the same. Okay, so it's easy to explain direct exchange ratios using it. But now you say, okay, well, how do we explain money? And that is a little bit tricky because it ends up, it looks like if you try to go down that path, it looks like if you try to take the Mengerian approach, the subjective marginal utility approach, in order to explain money, it looks like at first that you're going to use a circular argument. So let me just explain really quickly what I mean by that. And again, if you're getting intimidated, don't worry. I'm walking through this slowly just to try not to lose you, but this isn't a huge component of what you need to know for this topic. But what the reason they bumped up against the wall is they went like this. They said, okay, what we're trying to explain is why is it, say, that an ounce of gold can go out in the marketplace and fetch me a horse, why not 10 horses, or why not half of a horse? So they're trying to explain the purchasing power of money. They're trying to understand why is it that an ounce of gold can buy me a certain amount of stuff, but not more or not less. They want to understand quantitatively why is that. And so it looked like if you wanted to use the subjective marginal approach, it looked like you were going to argue in a circle, because it looked like what you would have to say is, oh, well, okay, the reason, like the guy who owns the horse, the reason he would give up one horse for an ounce of gold is that he knows the ounce of gold can go buy things in the marketplace that are worth one horse, right? So that's why he would be willing to make that trade. Because if the ounce of gold could only buy stuff in the marketplace that would trade for half a horse, then why would he give up one whole horse just to get an ounce of gold? See what I'm saying? That would be silly. Okay, so I hope you see where this is going. It looked like you were saying, oh, the reason somebody would sell one horse for an ounce of gold is that people are willing to sell one horse for an ounce of gold. So it doesn't look like I just walked in a circle. I didn't really explain it. I could have just easily, in other words, no matter what the purchasing power of money happened to be, we could explain it by just saying, oh, well, that's the purchasing power of money. That's why people are willing to give up valuable goods and services in those ratios for the money, because they know the money has that kind of purchasing power and it's worth it. And so it looked like you're just arguing in a circle. So that's where it kind of stopped. Notice you didn't hit that kind of problem when you're just talking about direct exchange. Somebody who wanted to bake bread and who started out with 18 horses, it made sense to say, oh, well, he'd give up that 18th horse in exchange for 16 pounds of flour because he wants to go make a certain amount of bread. And so you're explaining it in terms of, well, because with his 17 remaining horses, he can still ride around and he can still pull the stagecoach and he can still blah, blah, blah. You know, so all the things that you're going to do with your horses, you can just figure out, if I have 18 horses, how much stuff can I get done? If I only have 17 horses, how much stuff can I get done? Okay. And then with the flour, if I start out with zero, how much bread can I make? Okay. What if I acquire 16 pounds of flour? How much bread can I? Okay. And so ultimately, you're trading off the stuff you're not able to do with your horses if you have one fewer horse, and then counterbalance against the number of loaves of bread you can make if you get that much more flour. And so there's no contradiction there. You can just say, oh, well, the reason the horse trades for that is because people like to have this many loaves of bread, and they get, this kind of stuff they can do with horses, and that's just the way people's preferences are. So there's no circular argument. But with money, the only reason you value money in its capacity as money is that it has a purchasing power. That's what money is, as money, right? I mean, so we're not talking about getting the gold and then making it into a necklace. We're talking about if you're getting gold coins, intending to use them as money down the road to buy stuff with. The point is, what determines how much you're willing to give up to get those gold coins? Well, the answer is clearly you could say, yeah, oh, well, I give up stuff that I value less than the money. But why do you value it as money? Because it has purchasing power. And so that's what we're trying to explain. Okay, but why does it have purchasing power? So that's where it seems to be a circular argument. It looks like you're saying money has purchasing power because money has purchasing power. So people thought, oh, Menger's contribution is great. It explains barter or direct exchange, but it doesn't really explain the value of money. So Mises came along, and this is what he did in his book, The Theory of Money and Credit. That's obviously an English translation. He wrote it in German. And he solved this issue. What he did is he broke it up into a time element. Okay, so Mises said, no. It's not that you're explaining the purchasing power of money by the purchasing power of money. You're right. That would be a circular argument. He says, really what's happening is the purchasing power of money right now comes from people who are willing to give up goods and services to get money. But why are they doing that? Because they're making expectations about the future. They think that this money they're getting now is going to have purchasing power down the road, and that's what they're picturing. Where do they get those expectations from? From the immediate past. And so Mises didn't say it like this, but the way I like to crystallize it is to say money's purchasing power today, or money's value in the market today, is based off of people's expectations of money's value in the market tomorrow. And where do they come up with the basis for those expectations? It's from their direct experience of what money bought in the marketplace yesterday. Okay, so you see, that's not a circular argument anymore. We're not explaining the value of money by the value of money. We're saying the value of money today is based on our expectations of its value tomorrow. And where do we get those expectations from? From what we observed of its value in the market yesterday. So there's no circular argument going on anymore. Okay. But then, all right. Well, wait a minute, Mises. That doesn't solve that, or that solves that problem. You're right. It's not a circular argument. But now, haven't you just opened yourself up to an infinite regress? Because now, ultimately, Mises is saying money's purchasing power today. By the way, in case I'm losing you guys, what I mean by the phrase purchasing power just means a unit of money, what can it buy you in the marketplace? All right, so if money has a high purchasing power, you don't have to use many units of money to get a lot of stuff. If money has a low purchasing power, you have to use lots of units of money to get other goods and services. So when there's rampant inflation, that means the purchasing power of money is going down. Okay, so but now it looks like, okay, Mises may have gotten around that circular argument or the claim that there's a circular argument involved. Because what Mises wants to do, just in case you're losing the big picture, Mises wants to be able to use Menger's framework. Mises wants to say, the same framework that we use to explain some value in a direct exchange, I, Ludwig von Mises, want to use that to explain everything, all exchanges, whether the commodity on one side of the trade happens to be money or whether it's just a consumption good. I want to use the same framework. I don't want to have two separate systems, one to explain barter ratios and then the other to explain the absolute dollar prices. He didn't want that. He said, no, there should be one standard framework of explaining valuation. And so he was just trying to show, it's a little bit trickier when you're deploying that framework on goods that happen to be money, but he said it's the same framework. Okay, so that's what he's trying to do here. So the critic says, wait a minute, Mises. Okay, I agree with you. You solved the circular argument objection, but now you've just opened yourself up to infinite regress. Because basically what you're doing is you're saying money's purchasing power today is ultimately based on what you observed as its purchasing power yesterday. So like let me just give you a real world example. So right now, why would you be willing to sell your used computer for $300? Because you have a rough idea of what $300 can buy in the marketplace. And how do you know that? Well, because you have observed that. Like just yesterday, you were out at the store and you saw how much things cost, and you have a rough sense of what $300 can get you. And so when someone says, hey, I'll give you $300 for your new laptop, you sit there and think about all the things you could get with $300, and you decide you would rather those things than your used laptop. And so you say, sure, here's my laptop, give me the $300. So ultimately what you're comparing mentally is the value you get from the things you could get with the $300 compared to just keeping your laptop. And so the money is just a medium of exchange. It's a way for you to acquire those other things. So notice the only way you can even do that is if you have some idea of what $300 will get you. So put it this way. Suppose you were in a coma for 20 years and you woke up and then you still had all your property. And then someone comes along to you and says, hey, I'll give you $1,800 for that laptop. You would, if you were smart, you would say, well, wait, I can't tell you that. I need to go out and look around first because I've been in a coma for 20 years. I have no idea what $1,800 is even worth anymore. For all I know, that'll give me a pack of chewing gum. In which case, no, I'd rather keep my laptop. Okay, so you see how that works? You need to have some inkling of what money can buy you or what its purchasing power is before you start trading things against money. Okay, so what the critic was saying to Mises was, okay, all you've really done then is you said you can explain the purchasing power of money today by what its purchasing power was yesterday, because everyone saw that. So you haven't really solved the problem, you just pushed it back a step. And so what explains money's purchasing power yesterday? Well, geez, Mises, you're just going to say go 2 days ago and then go 3 days ago. And so, you know, you're not really solving the problem. You're just deferring it and just we have to keep going back with it the rest of the time. And then Mises says, oh, no, we wouldn't. And you've probably heard this if you follow Austrian economics. This is what we now call a regression theorem. I don't think Mises called it that in the theory of money and credit, but I think he did call it that later. So Mises says we don't have to go back forever. All we have to do is go back until we're back in the days of direct exchange when the commodities in question were not used as media of exchange, but instead they were just used as regular commodities. So like if it's gold and silver, there was a point in the distant past when people just used gold and silver because they were metals that had all kinds of useful properties, not because they intended to trade them away for something else. And in that community that relied exclusively on direct exchange, goods would still have exchange ratios against each other. And you know, Menger showed us how to compute those or the principles by which those would be determined. And then something emerged as a medium of exchange. Other things may have. There was a competition of sorts, and then something eventually became money. And so if you ask on that first day when the thing first became money because it was widely accepted, if you said, how did the people know what its purchasing power was? You'd say, well, because they looked at yesterday when it was still a medium of exchange and it had a purchasing power. And you say, well, how did they know then? Well, they looked at the day before, and you just keep going back. So the day when that thing first became a medium of exchange, it wasn't yet money, but the first time someone accepted that thing intending to trade it away to somebody else, the reason he knew it had a certain ability to trade for something else was because it was a good in the marketplace. It was direct exchange. And it would have had exchange, you know, he would have been able to see people trading eggs for bacon or whatever. So he would know that some people do like bacon because he would see it with his own eyes. And that would give him a framework for saying, oh, wait a minute, I took that bacon intending to give it to the cobbler, then I could get my shoes repaired. So maybe he had seen with his own eyes somebody else giving the cobbler bacon the day before in a direct exchange. Right? So that's how Mises solves these problems, and that's why I'm not going to get into Bitcoin here, I mean, unless you guys ask me the Q&A. But that's so now that you know what the regression theorem is, you can see why this comes up in the argument over Bitcoin. Because some people are claiming because Bitcoin never was just a regular commodity the way gold and silver were, how could it possibly be a money? All right, so I'm not saying that's a good argument or a bad argument. I'm telling you why people are making that, because now that I told you what the regression theorem is. Okay, I don't see anybody posting questions in the Q&A yet, so I'm just going to keep going with the main lecture. So let me just spend we've got like 13 minutes left at this point. So let me just go ahead and just keep going here. There's one last slide I want to talk about, the historical gold standard. So what I want to do here is not give you so much the history. I want to walk you through the logic of how it works, because I rarely see people get into this level of specificity. And I know I personally didn't really like resonate deeply with me as to how the gold standard actually worked until I personally thought through an example like the one I'm going to go through with you here. So that's the reason I'm doing this. Just to give you the big picture for the United States, up until 1933, there was what we call the classical gold standard, where anybody who had U.S. currency could exchange it for a definite weight of gold. When Franklin Delano Roosevelt came in, one of the first things he did in office in early 1933 was he suspended that option. And then going forward, as codified in what was called the Bretton Woods Agreement, the U.S. government agreed that it would redeem dollars. It would give gold to people in exchange for dollars, but not just anybody. It would only do it with other governments or central banks. All right, and then finally, in 1971, the U.S. government just threw in the towel and said, we're not even going to give other governments or central banks any gold in exchange for dollars. So at that point, the dollar became a true what's called fiat currency. And that word is spelled F-I-A-T. So a fiat currency means it's not backed up by anything. Where the word comes from is to say that, you know, if you have two rectangular green pieces of paper that both have a 50 and a dollar sign on it, what makes one of them a genuine $50 bill and the other one just a worthless green piece of paper that has some numbers on it, symbols? Well, the U.S. government comes up with a bunch of somewhat arbitrary rules to say this really is a $50 bill, but this thing is not. I don't know if this happened to you guys, but have you seen the new $100 bills? They literally look like Monopoly money. I guess they came out, I don't know, 6 months ago or something. But I just, for whatever reason, I guess because I'm not a high roller at the casino or something, I hadn't seen it for a while. And somebody at the bank tried to give it to me about a month ago, and I was sort of taken aback. I said, what is this? And they're just looking at me like I was nuts. I said, yeah, it's a $100 bill. And they say, oh, that's real. And I didn't get into a philosophical discussion with the lady, but it struck me about the only reason she was saying that thing was real, whereas if I tried to pull out a $100 bill from a Monopoly game, she would say, no, that's obviously not money, is that the U.S. government told her, trust us, that's a $100 bill. So anyway, that's what this word fiat means. It means, you know, the government is declaring by fiat that these things are money and these things are not. Now, incidentally, let me just take 15 seconds on this, and then I'll get back to the gold standard discussion. Don't read too much into that phrase, that term. the government does not have the power to just make something money, right? There's a whole history to get us to the point where the government is in a position to say that's a $100 bill, but this thing over here is not. Okay, so I don't want you to read too much into what I just said. The government does not have the power. Like, they couldn't just all of a sudden make seashells money. That probably wouldn't work. Okay, and for sure, a government just from scratch that didn't have any history with its people about what money was could not just start declaring things money. Okay. For some of the reasons we've talked about in this class already. Okay, but anyway, I don't want to get into that right now. Let's come back to the gold standard discussion. I just don't want you to take what I just said about fiat money too literally and think that we just said the government can do whatever it wants and declare something money. It's more subtle than that. But okay, back to the historical gold standard. How did that work? Well, governments would declare redemption rates of their currencies in terms of weights of gold. So, you know, the British government, its money was the pound. The U.S. government, it was the dollar. The French government, it was the franc. The German mark, and so on. So each government during this period of what's called the classical gold standard, so before World War I, each of these major governments, they would have their own national currency, and that was the unit of measurement that people would use in their contracts. And then you go to a store in Germany, stuff would be priced in marks. And you go to a store in the United States, it would be priced in dollars and so on. But all of those respective currencies were ultimately, it wasn't merely that they were pegged to, but they were defined as weights of either gold or silver. All right, so that it's really it's hard nowadays that we're used to, we've all grown up with fiat money, it's hard to get back in that mindset. Like, you know, there are certain documents in U.S. legislation, for example, that literally define a dollar as a certain amount of grams of silver and things like that. So it's not just that they were setting something like in terms of monetary policy. It was more of a definition, just like for purposes of law and to facilitate contracts, the governments might all say, hey, 1 foot equals 12 inches. Okay, so that was a definition to just help people understand what those terms meant, so that if somebody had a dispute in a contract and went to a judge, there would be some standard. Okay, and so by the same token, when the government said that this many dollars equal this much weight in gold, that wasn't like monetary policy to try to achieve full employment. No, that was like a definition of this is what we mean by the term dollar. And so if in a contract you agree to pay someone $20 for something and somebody brings that to a judge, what do they actually mean by that phrase? Well, they mean this much gold. Okay, so you see how that's different from how people nowadays think in terms of what the government does with money? Okay, but back to the discussion. So just to give you a concrete example, before 1933 in the United States, the way the definitions worked out when they would define what a dollar was, if you had $20.67, that would get you 1 ounce of gold. So that's so the U.S. government stood prepared to anybody who brought in $20.67 worth of currency, you know, green pieces of paper issued by the Treasury, could hand those into the proper authority, and then the U.S. government was legally obligated, pledged to the world, we will give you 1 ounce of gold. So the government had to keep stockpiles of gold to be able to do that. And like I said, anybody could do that. It wasn't like you had to be a representative from the Bank of France. Just anybody who happened to have U.S. currency had the right to do that. Okay. And so then, whereas in Great Britain, what their pledge was, is they said if you had 4.25 British pounds, then the Bank of England would give you an ounce of gold. So those were the what the two governments set in terms of the redemption ratios of their respective currencies. So now if you think through it, you know, what does that mean if you do the division, $20.67 divided by 4.25 British pounds, that meant that the anchor point, if you will, in the foreign exchange markets was that $4.86 US dollars you would think should trade for one British pound. Now, that wasn't a law of nature. It wasn't like that was a price control. It was just saying, given that the U.S. government legally was obligated to give 1 ounce of gold for $20.67, and that the British authorities were legally obligated to give 1 ounce of gold for 4.25 British pounds, that this ratio right here, that you would expect the natural equilibrium point in the currency markets would be $4.86 of U.S. money would trade for one British pound. Now, in practice, the actual exchange rate would deviate. Maybe it'd be 487, 488, maybe it'd be 485, 484, trading for a British pound. But what we're going to see here, this is the last point that I'll make in the remaining 2 minutes we have, because the U.S. government stood ready to redeem gold at this ratio and the British government at this ratio, there wasn't much scope for the exchange rate to deviate too much from this anchor point. So let me just show you what would happen. Suppose, and that's what this last point is here, suppose for the sake of argument that the U.S. government starts printing money like crazy, but this is still, like, let's say in the year 1912, okay? So they're still on the hook to redeem gold, $20.67 for an ounce of gold, and the British government's still on the hook to do 4.25 pounds. All right, so the U.S. government, for whatever reason, starts printing dollars like crazy. So now Americans have more dollars, and they want to buy stuff from, you know, and prices in the U.S. start rising. So now British goods look relatively more attractive, right? The British tea or sweaters or something are look cheaper now because tea in the United States and sweaters in the United States, their dollar price is getting pushed up because now there's more dollars floating around, okay? And so now more Americans start trying to buy British stuff, but the people in Britain now don't want to buy as much stuff from the United States because the dollar prices, those things are getting pushed up. Okay, so now that means more Americans want to buy British stuff, so how do you do that? Well, people in Britain don't accept dollar bills. What happens is the Americans take their dollars and go to the foreign exchange market and have to buy pounds with it before they can then go to the British merchants and buy the tea. So instead of being 486 a pound, now it goes to 487, 488, 489, 490. And so the dollar starts getting undervalued relative to the pound. So the point is, eventually, if that process continues too much, and this, I'll wrap this up in like 2 minutes here, if that process continues too much, at some point, it allows for an arbitrage opportunity. If that discrepancy gets too big, if the exchange rate strays too much from this 486 anchor point, then eventually it makes sense for people in Great Britain to take an ounce of gold, let's say, or 100 ounces of gold, and then they go to the Bank of England and they get, you know, let's say 425 pounds for the 100 ounces of gold, okay? Then they take the 425 pounds and they go into the foreign exchange markets and they get more than $486 for it, all right? And so, or times 4.25. See what I'm saying? For every pound, they get more than $4.86. And so then they take those dollars and then they go to the U.S. government and they say, give us all this gold. And so they end up with more than 100 ounces of gold if you just do the numbers, right? Because if it were 1 pound for 486 exactly in the foreign exchange markets, they would just break even. They would start with 100 ounces of gold in Great Britain, exchange it for pounds, take the pounds of the foreign exchange market, get dollars, take the dollars to the U.S. government, get gold, and they would end up just with 100 ounces of gold. But since now the dollar is trading for more than 486, that's going to give them a slight edge, and they're going to take their original 100 ounces of gold in Great Britain and end up with, I'm making this number up, let's say 110 ounces of gold in the United States. And then they say, ship the gold over here. And so the gold gets put on a boat and goes across the ocean because they got rid of their 100 ounces of gold when they gave it to the Bank of England to get the pounds, and now they want to get the gold back. And so now they get the 110 that's coming on the boat from the United States. So if you think of it in terms of the authorities, the British government now has 100 ounces more gold than it did before, and the American authorities have 110 fewer ounces of gold. And so what happens is, as if the United States authorities are printing dollars faster than the British authorities are printing pounds, that causes the dollar to fall against the pound in the foreign exchange market, and that causes an outflow of gold from U.S. government's vaults effectively into British vaults. And so the U.S. government realizes, oh man, we got to stop printing so much or else we're going to run out of gold. Right? Or technically the British government could say, well, we're accumulating all this gold, we can go ahead and fire the printing press as well. So that little story I just told you just shows you the logic of it. If one country under the classical gold standard is inflating its paper stockpile and paper monies faster than the others, it will tend to experience an outflow of gold from its vaults to the other countries. And so since you have a bunch of competing countries, constituent members, it sort of was a check upon everybody that, yeah, they could inflate, but only if they could all agree to inflate together. If any one of them inflated more rapidly than the other, that one country would lose its gold to the others. Okay, so all it took to maintain order was that at least one country had to be conservative, and then nobody else could inflate more than the slowest country. Otherwise, that slowest inflating country would get everybody's gold. Okay, so that was how the classical gold standard worked. So it wasn't totally free market, obviously. Still, government had a lot of intervention, but the point was when they all respected that pledge that they would redeem their national currencies for gold of a specified weight, it placed a major constraint on what they could do. And so knocking down the classical gold standard, that happened in World War I. Every country except the U.S. went off the gold standard because they didn't want that discipline. They wanted to be able to print money so they could buy munitions for the war. And nowadays, with absolute fiat money on everybody's part, there are no constraints. So this is why Mises in particular, and then a lot of people associated with libertarianism, especially in the Austrian tradition, have such a fondness for the days of the classical gold standard, because that was historically a strong check on government's ability to debase the currency. Okay, well, we're out of time. Let me stop there. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in. And if you can, try to get caught up for the reading for next week. And I will blast out an email tomorrow telling you when the office hours are going to be for this week. So we'll definitely have them this week. In week two, I'm not as sure because I'm going to be at a conference in Long Island, and I'm not sure how that's going to work out. But I'll let you know either way. But for sure, we'll have it this week.